It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. The tragic massacre of members of an African-American prayer group at the Emmanuel AME Church in Charleston, South Carolina, has stunned the nation. While the Charleston police chief says his department is investigating the shooting as a hate crime, South Carolina does not have laws to this effect, one of only five states without hate crime laws on the books. But there are many who wonder what constitutes a hate crime. I'm joined now by phone by Wilson Hune, Distinguished Professor Emeritus at the University of Akron School of Law. Professor Hune, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Thank you very much. I also happen to be an adjunct professor at your very own Duquesne University, so very fond of your city.
Well, thank you for saying that and sharing that. And if you have a comment or a question for our guest, Wilson Hune, you can call 412-246-2002. That's 412-246-2002. Email is esspgh@wesa.fm and on Twitter at esspgh. Again, the number, 412-246-2002. Professor Hune, what constitutes a hate crime?
Well, a hate crime is just like any other crime, except that the motivation is different, Paul. The motivation is hatred. It is with the crime was committed because of the person's race or religion or gender or sexual orientation or disability.
What additional punishment does it bring?
It varies with different laws. There are, as you already stated, 45 states, and the District of Columbia has these laws. Federal government has these laws. But it, in all cases, enhances the punishment. It moves it from a less serious felony to a more serious felony, which means additional prison time.
Are there special challenges in prosecuting a hate crime?
Oh, yes. With this particular crime, the motivation is one of the elements of the offense. And as with every other crime, the prosecution has the responsibility to prove every single element beyond a reasonable doubt. And it's sometimes difficult to prove motive, of course. That's going to be a more difficult element than it is proving what precisely happened physically. So, yes, there are additional challenges in proving hate crimes. It's pretty obvious in the South Carolina case, I suppose. But in other cases, it's going to be very difficult to prove that the motive was, for example, motivated by sexual orientation rather than just general drunkenness and anger.
Right. And in a case unlike the one in Charleston, which, as you said, as you pointed out, appears to be a very obvious case of what the intent of this young gunman was. But in other cases, what do you have to prove? What do you have to make very clear to a jury about intent and that under the definition of hate crime?
Well, you have to prove that subjectively this was what motivated this particular individual. So it can't be something where we prove that it might have been their race or it might have been gender or sexual orientation. The government has to prove what was specifically in another person's mind. So
how do you do that?
Well, in general, you want to have their own words.
Mm-hmm.
You want to show that what the people said at the time of the offense, or perhaps when they were planning it, was directed on the basis of hatred. That is the most common way of proving this. If we don't bring in specific evidence showing that this was their intent, the judge is going to essentially direct a verdict of acquittal, or the judge is going to say, I'm not going to let that go to the jury. Because remember, the standard is proof beyond a reasonable doubt. So there has to be evidence sufficient that a reasonable jury could find beyond a reasonable doubt that this was the person's motivation.
Can the Charleston Police Department investigate last week's shooting as a hate crime, even though South Carolina does not have hate crime laws on the books?
Oh, absolutely. They can pursue every angle because, of course, in every crime you want to establish motive. It's not a necessary element in other types of crimes, but motive is very persuasive evidence that the person did the crime, and that is why prosecutors almost always try to introduce evidence of motive. It's going to be a rare case where the prosecution goes forward with a case where they're not able to show, persuade the jury that this person had a reason for committing the crime.
We're talking with Wilson Hune, who is a distinguished professor emeritus at the University of Akron School of Law, also an adjunct professor at Duquesne University in Pittsburgh. And we're talking about what constitutes a hate crime. And we're going to get into some of the evolution of the legislation involving hate crimes. If you have a comment or question, some aspect of the legal system that you're wondering about, 412-246-2002 is the number to call. Again, 412-246-2002. Our email address, essph@wesa.fm, and on Twitter at essph. Again, the number, 412-246-2002. Professor Hune, what can you tell us about the evolution of hate crimes legislation? I guess it goes back to the mid to late 1980s, is that right?
Yeah, in its modern form, but you can find this kind of legislation adopted right after the Civil War. The Reconstruction Congress in the years after the Civil War, Paul, adopted a number of civil rights laws, including laws prohibiting what we today call hate crimes, crimes that were committed on account of the person's race. Most of these laws were struck down as unconstitutional by the Supreme Court in the 50 or 60 years following the Civil War. The Supreme Court was very, very hostile to civil rights legislation, and that struck down the hate crime laws, along with, we actually had a public accommodations law adopted in 1875 after the Civil War. The Supreme Court said that was unconstitutional, too. So, yeah, the modern incarnation of these is in the last 30 years. Of course, the most recent one is the Matthew Shepard and James Byrne Act adopted in 2009 by the federal government.
Are there misconceptions about hate crimes?
Yeah, I would say the most common argument against this, and you found this being argued against the Shepard-Byrne law in 2009 in Congress, the most common misconception is that this creates a special class of persons who are protected and other people aren't protected, that it creates special rights for certain individuals. And I think that's a misconception. These laws protect everybody. They protect you. They protect me. They protect everybody. Nobody can be assaulted on account of race. Nobody can be assaulted on account of religion. Nobody can be assaulted on account of sexual orientation. Now, the number of people who are assaulted because they are heterosexual is vanishingly small, and there are thousands of violent crimes against people based on sexual orientation over a five-year period, over 3,000 violent assaults on gays and lesbians and others. And only about 40 assaults on heterosexuals. Nevertheless, it protects everybody. It's the most famous case, Wisconsin versus Mitchell, involved an assault by a group of black men against a white man. And that was a race-motivated crime. And the Supreme Court in that case said, these laws are constitutional. That was 1993. And they're constitutional. Chief Justice Rehnquist said, let me get the quote here. He said, this conduct is thought to inflict greater individual and societal harm. For example, according to the state, bias-motivated crimes are more likely to provoke retaliatory crimes, inflict distinct emotional harms on the victims, and incite community unrest. We certainly see that community unrest, don't we?
Charleston and
other places.
Yes. And there is an associate professor of law at the University of Pittsburgh, Lu-In Wang, who calls current hate crime laws too narrow, saying that they must be placed in the context of society in general instead of looking at them as an isolated form of deviant behavior, something legal scholars and legislators tend to do, according to Lu-In Wang. Is there a risk here of oversimplifying the complex phenomenon that we call hate?
Well, I'm not sure if it's oversimplified so much as the fact that it's true that we aren't addressing it enough. Look at the response to the horrific murders in Charleston. People want to close their eyes to it. We don't want to admit that we have this terrible sickness of racism in our society or homophobia. It's not a pretty thing. And I think that there is a very strong level of denial in the United States about these things. If you have a certain kind of situation like slavery, for example, for 200 or 300 years, that doesn't disappear overnight, as the president said. We have a lot of work to do in our society, and it's true this is just one way that we can work on this particular problem. There are lots of other things that are going on that hopefully will address racism, other forms of prejudice.
And an issue facing legislators is whether expanding the definition of hate crimes or increasing the penalty for them acts as a deterrent. Does it?
You know, it's hard to tell, Paul. Certainly the number of hate crimes has decreased in the last 20 years. 20 years ago, there were 10 or 11,000 of these crimes every year. Now we're looking at about 7,000 a year. So you could argue that it's been a deterrent. On the other hand, the number of violent crimes in the United States has been cut in half over the same period. So we haven't seen the decrease in hate crimes that we have seen in violent crimes overall. And I'm not sure what to make of that, Paul, but it would seem to indicate that we've still got a long way to go in addressing the underlying causes of hate crimes.
And just to clarify something, Luann Wang was an associate professor of law at the University of Pittsburgh at the time that those comments were made, and is now at the University of New Mexico. So just to clarify that, with regard to what has happened in South Carolina, it's been a very difficult week for people down there. How do you see this case being dealt with going forward in a state that does not have hate crime laws on the books?
Well, first of all, I would like to salute the community of Charleston. I earlier said that there was unrest, and I didn't mean that there was violence. In fact, the response of the black community and the white community in Charleston has been admirable. But it does cause horrible upset. It brings these rifts right to the forefront. And of course, one of the ways in which they are trying to address this is by thinking again about having the Confederate flag flying in front of the State House. There are those who say that the Confederate flag, for example, represents Southern pride or Southern heritage. But, you know, those people have to ask themselves, does it represent the pride of all the people of South Carolina? Does it represent the heritage of all the people of South Carolina or only some of the people? And that is obviously a sore subject, a deep cultural rift that they will have to confront and that they are confronting going forward.
My guest has been Wilson Huhn. He is Distinguished Professor Emeritus at the University of Akron School of Law, also an adjunct professor at Duquesne University, talking about the definition of a hate crime. Professor Huhn, it's been good to talk with you. Thank you so much for spending some time with us here on Essential Pittsburgh.
You're very welcome, and thank you for the opportunity to speak to your audience.
Coming up, is sex ed doing its job? We'll talk with Samantha Bushman. She's founder of Talk, the new sex ed. It's Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA. It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. Is sex ed doing its job in keeping children healthy and making responsible choices? Some say the topic is rarely discussed openly, let alone effectively. So where are children getting their information for sexual health? Our next guest, Samantha Bushman, is founder and CEO of Talk, the new sex ed. She joins us in our studio along with Sue Berman, who is a parent and mother of a teenager who participated in this program. First of all, Samantha Bushman, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
And Sue Berman, good to have you with us.
Thank you.
If you have a comment or question, you can call us at 412-246-2002. That's 412-246-2002. Email is ESSPGH@WESA.FM and on Twitter at ESSPGH. Explain what you mean when you say that sex ed is broken, Samantha. What's going on?
In my preliminary research, when I spoke with teenagers and I said, where is this falling short for you? They were telling me we don't feel comfortable asking the questions that we want to know. And the sex ed that we're receiving doesn't really map on well to the realities of teenage life.
These are the kids saying this.
Correct. Correct.
And so where, if children aren't getting their information in sex ed, where are they getting their information for sexual health?
I mean, everywhere else, right? So we live in a sex-saturated culture that's uncomfortable talking about sex. So kids are getting bombarded constantly through various forms of media, pornography on the internet, friends, uninformed friends, pretty much every place from aside from trusted sources and from parents, which is where they say consistently that they wish they were having some more productive conversations.
Besides, as you say, porn on the internet, is the and I don't think anybody would argue with you when you say that sex has permeated so many aspects of our culture, saturated a lot of popular culture. It comes up. It seems like you can't write a sitcom anymore without, you know, some sexual innuendo coming into play. You know, it's certainly in music, so it's all over pop culture. So, with that in mind, does that create even more of a challenge than might have existed decades ago, when kids were in school, you know, taking sex ed as in its elementary school form that a lot of us remember?
So not very much has changed, right? So there's been no upgrading of any of the content since.
Not much has changed in the curriculum.
Correct. Correct. But, you know, kids are exposed and are taking in a lot more. And there's really not very much opportunity for them to think and process with grown-ups that can help them think through what does this mean. In our program, a lot of the time we spend looking at peer norms and cultural assumptions and things that we take for granted that... So let me back up for a second. So one thing that we know is that what we think other people are doing has a profound impact on how we choose to behave, but we're really poorly calibrated on what other people are doing. So if I think everyone is having sex, I might be more likely to have sex when really not everybody is having sex. Do you know what I mean? So in terms of things like that, that's just one of the frames we try to give kids to help them think through what are my beliefs and values? How do I act in accordance with them? And not so much what do I think I'm supposed to be doing?
And if kids have questions, wouldn't they be more likely in this day and age to talk with their parents? It might be a little harder to approach your parents, say, in the Leave It to Beaver days, June and Ward Cleaver, you know, might not be the first people you'd want to go to have that discussion with.
Sure.
But things have changed. You know, the parenting has changed, and it seems that there's a little more openness. What makes it so hard for parents and kids to talk, as you say?
So I think part of the issue is that a lot of parents, at least the ones that I've worked with, and Sue I'm sure could also speak to this, is that they don't have a framework for how these conversations are supposed to go because their June Cleaver and Leave It to Beaver family didn't speak with them, right? So what to say, how to say it, and where to start is not often clear.
So because the discussions did not happen with previous generations, the newer generations are finding it difficult to come up with a way to break the ice on these conversations simply because they don't have a template, a reference point, that kind of thing?
Sometimes. It definitely depends. I think, you know, another piece of the puzzle is that parents think that they don't influence their kids' decisions about sex. Parents consistently cite the influence of friends and the media as most consistently acting on them. But we have...
So because of that, they throw up their hands and say, what can I possibly do? Because there's an influence that's stronger that supersedes anything I might say to my children.
Exactly. When consistently the research shows there's some really powerful data from the National Campaign to End Teen and Unplanned Pregnancy that says kids consistently say that parents most influence their decisions about sex. And so there's a huge missed opportunity. They also say that it would be easier to delay sex and to avoid unintended pregnancy and sexually transmitted infections if they were able to have more open and honest conversations with their parents.
And let's talk with our parent, Sue Berman. Sue, as a parent, are you concerned with the sexual images and messages that your child is exposed to?
Well, sure. I think there's, as you have already said, just a saturation of imagery and media about sex and sexuality. But I know that we're not going to change that. I mean, in the time that I have to raise kids, that shift isn't going to happen. We're not going to change that. So I know that I have to parent in that culture, right? I have to be prepared to have those conversations knowing that's out there.
Is it also a situation, Sue or Samantha, where the conversation is being taken out of the hands of the parents, that if they don't have the conversation early enough, and it's probably happening earlier now than it used to happen, if they don't have it by a certain time, the child is going to know because of the whatever images he or she sees. They're asking their friends about it, or they're going on the internet to read more about a reference, or to define some sexual term that they might have heard somewhere. Is that kind of what is happening here, that it's just sort of being taken away from the parents' control?
I think one of the important reframes that not only myself and talk, but a lot of people in the field are trying to do is to move it away from the talk and move the idea to more of an ongoing conversation. So when kids are young...
At some point, the parents would say, I'm going to have to tell my kids about the birds and the bees.
Yes.
But I guess what I was asking about earlier is by the time you're ready to have that talk, it's too late.
I usually find that there's a 2-year bias. Whenever you think that you're supposed to have a conversation with your kid, they probably actually knew that 2 years before. Mm. And the things that kids look to their parents about is sometimes the reason that parents don't talk. Kids don't want to hear from their parents the logistics about intercourse, the logistics of birth control, protocols for sexually transmitted infection testing. That's what they tend to look to professional educators for. They want to know from their parents, what kind of relationships do you want me to be in? What should I look for in a relationship partner? How does that differ between a dating partner and somebody I'm going to wind up with eventually? So how can the parents convey their own beliefs and values to guide their own teen's decision making?
We're talking with Samantha Bushman. She is the founder and CEO of Talk, the New Sex Ed, and someone who has participated in her program, a parent, Sue Berman. And you can join the conversation at 412-246-2002. That's 412-246-2002. Email is ESSPGH at WESA.FM and on Twitter at ESSPGH. I'm guessing there are more than a few people out there who might have some questions at this point. So again, the number 412-246-2002. Sue, what are or were your concerns in discussing sex with your daughter? And do you have one daughter or other children? Just one daughter?
One daughter, and I have a stepson as well.
Okay. So, you know that the time is coming sooner or later, sooner rather than later, probably. So what were the concerns that you've had, and maybe some of the things that might have inhibited you in some way from starting that conversation?
Well, I'm not a parent who's uncomfortable talking about those sort of things with my child. But I guess what I did was, and by the way, I'm in a class with Sam and with a lot of other parents, so I've heard a wide range of comfort and discomfort with these conversations from the other parents who are in the class. And so what I'm telling you is maybe different from what some of the other moms would say. I started that conversation very early in a very light way, very young. And then I did do what Sam's asking parents to do, which is to kind of have conversations over the course of many years, 5 years old, 7 years old, 8 years old, 10 years old, and just extend the conversation each time. I'm probably behind, as Sam says, that maybe something I said when my daughter was 13, she could have needed when she was 11 or 12. But I never think you've missed the opportunity or can have the opportunity taken away from you by some media source. They might get information, but it wouldn't be my beliefs or my values, and it might not be the right information. So maybe I'm giving new information. Maybe I'm giving corrective information. And certainly no media source can give my values.
Well, what about, Samantha, what about corrective information? If you are approaching this delicate subject of, you know, talking about sex with your teenage son or daughter, and they already have some information that may or may not be true or useful or appropriate, how do you undo that?
So the first step is recognizing the presence of misinformation, right? And then giving good information in its place. So just to have an essential part of talk is understanding where people are, meeting them where they are, and then filling their gaps in their information. So there's been a lot of updates. Whenever I work with a parent group, it's very important to me that the parents preview the information that the kids are going to get in the classroom. And there's been a lot of updates to birth control. There's been a lot of updates to sexually transmitted testing protocols, etc. So just to make sure that they have all the good information that the kids are getting. I find when I start, typically in middle school, 7th, 8th grade, they're usually pretty okay. They have a lot of curiosity questions about terms that they've heard on television or what's this thing over here that seems bizarre. And there's occasionally some misinformation. That tends to happen when longer periods of time pass in the absence of good sex ed, if that makes sense.
And you've created content that's tailored to each grade level.
Correct.
So can you walk us through how you gear the talk, as you call it, toward specific age groups?
Sure. So I spent 2 years at Carnegie Mellon as a fellow in their Institute for Social Innovation, basically looking at every program under the sun that had positive effects on adolescent behavior and making healthy decisions around around sexual health. And basically what I did in developing talk was to address the pitfalls and limitations of those approaches. And so one of the most important things is to make sure that you're meeting people where they are. So we have some over time developed different benchmarks of where we expect kids to be. And then, you know, just through a series of what we train our educators to do is really to do an ongoing assessment. So you're never giving them in the classroom any more information than they need at a particular time. You're not dumping information on them. You're really, if you make kids feel comfortable, they're very happy to tell you what it is that they don't know and what they feel like they need to know, if that makes sense.
Is there a concern among parents that the information they were given was wrong and so they're unsure if they're equipped to talk to their children? Sue, was that possibly a case? You sound like you're a lot more comfortable than some of these other parents may be, but could that have been the case for you?
It was the case for some of the parents who were in my group, and they openly said that to the class and to Sam, that there were things they didn't know or things they didn't know how to talk about or things they totally misunderstood, either about their own sexual health knowledge or about what they needed to convey to their kids. And they openly talked about that in the class. Oh, thank gosh, we talked about this because I was way off, or, oh, I didn't even know about that way of doing sexually transmitted infection testing, or, you know, they would openly talk about that. So there were lots of places where you could see parents kind of like their shoulders went down kind of in relief when they realized, okay, now I have good information. Or the other piece is a lot of moms took this class so that we would know what our kids were learning in their class, because that informs the conversations that we're going to have.
Sure.
You know, like, oh, I don't need to say that because it's been well covered. Or, oh, I do need to talk about this because they opened up that conversation in the student's class. So it was a nice back and forth of what parents were getting to know about what their students were knowing. And never was it, oh, your student said this or your student said that. It was, this is what we're doing in the 9th grade this year, or this is what we're doing in the 10th grade in this month-long, you know, segment of our class. And then we as parents could know what kinds of questions we were going to get and what kinds of curiosities the kids might have at a particular time.
412-246-2002 to join our conversation about the new sex ed. We're talking with the founder and CEO of Talk, the New Sex Ed, Samantha Bushman, and also Sue Berman, who is one of the parents who's participated in this program. And Samantha, what has been the reaction of some of the parents to the program? Sue just talked about, you know, how some of the relief that some of the parents feel when they, you know, get correct information. What have you experienced?
Typically very welcoming and positive. Usually I get the question a lot, like, are people outraged by your presence? Are like, I'm waiting for it. It hasn't happened yet. So parents know.
Outraged about?
Just in general. Sometimes a lot of it is fueled from anxiety. Sex can make people anxious and worried, and I understand where it comes from and everything else. But really, and you know, there's a whole culture war going on around sex ed and who deserves the right to teach information to kids. And basically what Talk is saying, it shouldn't be, you know, the school or the parent. It should be the school and the parent in collaboration together with transparency. So it should be about the kid, right? Like, how do we give the kid the support and the information and the resources that they need to make good decisions?
Has anybody questioned your right to do this, to say, you know, why should this program supersede what the kids might be learning in school or the conversations they might have with their parents?
So I don't go any place where I'm not invited. So usually a school will say, hey, Talk, we need some help with our sexuality education. We'd love to partner with you so you could come in and work with our kids. And then every single parent, before any of our educators ever step foot in the classroom, we do an overview session. That's an open session where any parent in the school is welcome to come and ask any questions that they have about anything. They get to see me. I'm in the habit of saying, what's the question that you're afraid that a kid is going to ask and how I'll respond to it. I say, why don't you ask me that question and I'll tell you exactly how I'll respond to it. So that usually helps to bring the anxiety down. And at the end of the day, really, Talk believes that parents should be the primary sexuality educators of their kid. And if a parent, and parents also know their children best. So if a parent ever feels it's in their child's best interest not to participate, they are always welcome to opt their child out.
Was it shocking for you to find out that some parents were learning new information too?
Shocking might be a little strong. Sue gave you a very mellow reaction. Some people are like outraged that they didn't know information previously. Like sometimes I'll talk about things like female anatomy and, you know, how, you know, just with grownups, how just straight up female anatomy works. And they're like, wow, that would have been really helpful information. How did I go, you know, X number of years throughout my life without having that? That would have been really helpful. So sometimes they're actually angry that they didn't have this information for so long. So shocked, not really, because I mean, where would they get it from if they're not getting it from, I don't want to say me, but essentially.
Yeah, it's certainly changed a lot from, I think, what a lot of people experienced growing up, which was a very clinical talk from a phys ed teacher, mm-hmm. maybe, mm-hmm. or the health sciences teacher in the school, and maybe and a film that accompanied it that really didn't explain a whole lot. So what are your hopes for the future of these students in regards to sexual health?
I really feel at the end of the time, we were just talking about this before, at the end of the time I work with the school partners that I have now, when those kids graduate, I really feel like there's nothing that you can put in front of them that they wouldn't know how to deal with. So I feel like between the beliefs and values that they're going home and engaging their parents about, and we do give them homework regularly to go home and say, hey, talk to your mom about when she thinks it's appropriate for you to date, or hey, you know, so engaging the parents that way. But I really feel by the end, and the kids seem, this is reflected in the data, that we do pre and post program surveys with the kids, that there's really not too much that you can put in front of them they haven't already thought through how they would go about dealing with. When do I feel sexual activity is appropriate? Under what conditions would I feel comfortable engaging in sexual activity? Am I aware of all of the things that need to be in place? What does it mean to be a sexually healthy person? How do I negotiate this, that, and the other thing? Like, they really seem to feel very solid from where they come into the program at and where it is when they leave.
412-246-2002, the number to call. Let's go to Sally in Fox Chapel. Sally, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh. You're on with Samantha Bushman and Sue Berman.
Well, hi there. This sounds like an amazing program, but you know, my child is already getting sex ed in school, so I'm wondering, how does yours differ from what my child is getting?
I'm so very glad that you asked. So one of the challenges is that in a lot of sex ed program, there's not a whole lot of quality control going on. So basically, it's set at the district level. But then even two kids in separate classrooms can be getting different information based on the comfort level of the instructor. And, you know, as Paul mentioned earlier, sometimes it's the gym teacher, sometimes it's the science teacher. It's usually whoever can be dragooned into the role that maybe or maybe not did not sign up to be teaching sex ed.
And you're saying this has not changed? I guess you've been out there more than a lot of us mm-hmm. have, but it seems inconceivable that there wouldn't be a new approach. But you're saying There really hasn't been a new approach that developed within most school systems.
Not in school-based settings, no. There's lots of intervention-like programs, but in school-based settings, you know, and I would encourage everyone to look at what's mandated in the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania. Take a look at what's laid out and how much flexibility and freedom there is to work within the very broad parameters that are basically non-existent.
Why do you suppose that is?
I don't know if people know. I think sometimes people are very surprised. I gave a TEDx talk not long ago, and I talked about how only 22 states require that sexuality education be medically, technically, or factually accurate.
Really?
That's a big problem.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Like, I should think so.
So, and that's that have parameters about it at all, right? So there's states where, you know, there's no sex education mandated one way or the other, abstinence only or comprehensive sex ed. Doesn't matter. So
what were you finding? You know, I'm sure you were, as a concerned parent, wondering what are they teaching my daughter anyway? What did you find out?
Well, I haven't certainly done an analysis of what's offered in a lot of different schools, and talk is offered in the school where my daughter is. So I really didn't need to,
you were able to
go seek that out. But one of the questions that you asked was, why hasn't it changed, or why do you think that the parameters are so broad?
Well, look at the way society has changed. You would think that educators would look at this and say, what was taught in the 50s or even the 60s and 70s might not be as effective as some newer approach taken today.
So I'm going to take a flying guess because I honestly don't know. And Sam, you can correct me. But
yeah.
I think that sex and sexuality education are such kind of hot button third rail issues for the districts to handle and for the state to handle, that it just doesn't handle it. Like, it just doesn't come up in the conversations. So if there's a policy in place, whether that was in the 1960s or whenever it was, they just let it lay there, because to bring it up might cause like a school board meeting and a lot of parents of, I want you to do it this way, or I don't want you to teach my kid that thing. Or so if they just let it rest, they don't have to deal with any of the controversy. So, but letting it rest is creating bad outcomes or outcomes we can't possibly know, because everybody does it their own way.
We also know that the outcomes are not good, even if you just look at the situation that we have currently. So we have 19 million new cases of sexually transmitted infections every single year. Half of them occur in people ages 15 to 24, even though they're only a quarter of the sexually active population. Every other pregnancy in the United States is unintended. Every other pregnancy. So even just if you look at and forget about sexual abuse and sexual violence and all of these other public health issues, that our outcomes are just terrible. We're number one across the board among all nations in the Western industrialized world in terms of our poor outcomes.
Well, it's a program that is getting a lot of attention and certainly a lot of positive reaction. It's called Talk, the New Sex Ed, and the founder and CEO of this program, Samantha Bushman, has joined us here in studio, along with Sue Berman, a parent and a mother of a teenager who participated in the program. And we appreciate your providing a parent's perspective, Sue. And Samantha Bushman, thank you for being here to talk about this. And we wish you well in the future.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Coming up, what the research is showing about the benefits of yoga among those with diabetes. It's Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA. It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. A survey by the National Institute of Health shows the ancient practice of yoga is growing in popularity. Recent research is discovering the benefits of yoga practice among those who have diabetes. Mark Staley is a yoga instructor at Yoga Hive, a certified health coach and a certified holistic health practitioner with the American Association of Drugless Practitioners. And he is joining us here in studio to discuss the health benefits of yoga for diabetics. Mark Staley, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Thank you. Great to be here. I'm grateful.
And also with us is a certified yoga instructor from Boston, Janice Gabor. And I hope I'm pronouncing that name correctly. Janice, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh. Hello?
I think maybe you meant Lisa Nelson.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Practice physician.
Lisa Nelson.
I wrote the book Yoga and Diabetes with Annie Kay.
Okay, thank you. A late edition, and I'm glad to have you with us. Mark, let's start with you. Yoga is an ancient exercise that works your flexibility, strength, and balance, all while concentrating on breathing. What types of results or benefits have you seen in people whose overall health, in the overall health of people who continue to practice yoga?
Oh, well, it's all over the board. I mean, yoga in and of itself is a powerful practice because it brings to you a lot of mindfulness, which is something that you can carry into many different avenues of your life, as well as the physical aspect of it. You know, specific to diabetes, as well as many other ailments, yoga can help the body deal with it, and your focus, your mental state, helps you to, you know, deal with it as well, deal with any adverse things that you might be going through.
So I guess one of the things that people say with regard to diabetes is that stress can exacerbate or create problems.
Right.
So something that reduces that stress would then mitigate the complications of diabetes.
Exactly. Pranayama, the breath work, really helps you calm. And yoga in and of itself, or yoga, the most common yoga practice, is basically a moving meditation. So you walk out feeling very calm even though you've worked out. It's a lot different than working out really strongly at a studio with weights and stuff. It's a whole different type and approach to physical activity.
Lisa Nelson, does yoga, in terms of the ways in which it brings a clearing of the mind, a clearing of the head, is this a technique that can bring a better quality of life to diabetics?
Absolutely. I mean, I think what makes yoga unique as a form of exercise is what was already, already mentioned. We know from, just a vast body of data that any moderate cardiovascular exercise not only helps lower blood glucose levels or blood sugar, but over time also promotes insulin sensitivity. So yoga done, and in particular, the yoga postures that most people are familiar with, now when that's done at a moderate level, it can really help increase, people's control over their sugar and lower their blood sugar over time. But what makes yoga special, what your studio guest mentioned, was really this aspect of mindfulness and the way that mindful attention to our body can do two things. It can lower our stress levels, which in turn lower cortisol levels and lower our blood sugar. And I think more importantly, it helps us pay attention to our behavior. So some studies have shown that mindful eating techniques and eating meditation is as helpful in lowering blood sugar as carbohydrate counting.
And talk about the types of specific yoga that is recommended for diabetes or for diabetics.
Well, I think, one of the things that might be special about the population of folks who develop type 2 diabetes, in particular type 2 diabetes, which is about 90 to 95% of the total population of people in this country. So type 2 diabetes is really what we think of as a lifestyle condition. So we tend to get it if we're overweight, if we're sedentary, and it increases a lot the prevalence as we get older. So I am a big fan in people who are just starting to begin with gentle yoga, to especially if they haven't been active for many years, to find a nice restorative or gentle yoga practice. And even if they're not getting the cardiovascular benefits right away, they're going to get the stress reduction benefits that were already mentioned. And again, bringing that mindful self-care into a daily practice, which is really just so healing and transformative.
If you have a comment or question for our guest, Mark Staley, again, a yoga instructor at Yoga Hive, a certified health coach and certified holistic health practitioner, you can call us at 412-246-2002. That's 412-246-2002. Also with us, Lisa Nelson, who is a co-author of Yoga and Diabetes and, again, a medical director of the Kripalu Center in Western Massachusetts. 412-246-2002, the number to call if you have a question or a comment. And, Mark, I'm guessing that anything that reduces stress, in this case yoga, is not only good for diabetics, but for anybody that is dealing with some kind of chronic condition or disease, because so much of that is brought about by stress.
Exactly. I mean, heart disease, cardiovascular disease, a lot of, if you think even further back, not looking just at the disease itself, but just your habit when you're stressed of reaching for, you know, those foods that are comforting for you, that's the absent-mindedness approach that is causing a lot of damage. So you could really say that most of the diseases that we deal with, a lot of them, are related to our inability to be aware of how we're taking care of ourselves.
And so, Lisa, when people come to you who are having problems and they are accepting of this type of exercise and something that might introduce them to a new way of life, a new lifestyle, what are some of the reactions that you get?
Oh, I mean, the reactions have been wonderful. One of the reasons why Annie and I wrote this book is we work together at the Kripalu Center for Yoga and Health in Stockbridge, and we actually run a program called Prevent and Reverse Diabetes. And what we found by working with people, and they would come and stay at the retreat center for a week, is, you know, a lot of people have already heard the same message over and over again about how to treat their diabetes. Well, they need to lose weight. They don't know how. They need to cut back on their sugar. And as Mark said, you know, when we're stressed, we reach habitually for the foods that are hard for us. And so Annie and I found that in addition to providing, you know, medical information about diabetes, what was really needed for people to make behavior change, you know, to kind of apply the information to their own lives was yoga. And after these week-long programs, people would come out and I would get emails, you know, a month later, 2 months later saying, you know, I can't believe it. I've lost 20 pounds and my sugars are so good that we're cutting my medication in half. And, you know, I had no idea. So we really saw firsthand what a powerful tool yoga could be. And again, not just the postures, we're really talking about a particular mindset. And so thankfully the American Diabetes Association wanted to hear about it. And so they, you know, they have published the book. So there's, you know, there are a lot of people, the people who currently come to yoga, or at least maybe, I don't know, 10 years ago, tended to be people who are already healthy or already fit. And what's nice is that yoga is really entering the mainstream and becoming more accessible to people who, you know, may not want to put on a pair of spandex, but they can, you know, start at their own pace and apply these principles to their lives and get tremendous benefit.
And Mark, we're down to just about 30 seconds here, mm-hmm. but have you had clients who've, you know, I don't know if reversing their diabetes is the right term, but brought it under control because of their participation in yoga classes?
Well, not me particularly, but I know I'm 100% confident that that is possible and does and will happen. I mean, especially with a combination of a really good diet, yoga is a great way to go. I mean, it activates the pituitary gland and the pancreas, and it gets the insulin working again.
Mark Staley is a yoga instructor at Yoga Hive, a certified health coach, certified holistic health practitioner with the American Association of Drugless Practitioners. Mark, thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
And also Lisa Nelson, co-author of Yoga and Diabetes and medical director of the Kripalu Center in Western Massachusetts. Sorry for the confusion at the beginning, Lisa, but thank you for your participation. That's all the time we have.
Thank you so much.
I'm Paul Guggenheimer. So long for now.